This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents The Man in the Brown Suit by Agatha Christie, narrated by Nano Nagel. Prologue. Nadina, the Russian dancer, who'd taken Paris by storm, swayed to the sound of the applause, bowed and bowed again. Her narrow black eyes narrowed themselves still more. The long line of her scarlet mouth curved faintly upwards. Enthusiastic Frenchmen continued to beat the ground appreciatively as the curtain fell with a swish, hiding the reds and blues and magentas of the bizarre decor. In a swirl of blue and orange draperies, the dancer left the stage. A bearded gentleman received her enthusiastically in his arms. It was the manager.
"Magnificent, petit, magnificent," he cried. "Tonight you have surpassed yourself."
He kissed her gallantly on both cheeks in a somewhat matter-of-fact manner. Madame Nadina accepted the tribute with the ease of long habit and passed on to her dressing room, where bouquets were heaped carelessly everywhere. Marvellous garments of futuristic design hung on pegs, and the air was hot and sweet with the scent of the massed blossoms and with the more sophisticated perfumes and essences. Jean, the dresser, ministered to her mistress, talking incessantly and pouring out a stream of fulsome compliments. A knock at the door interrupted the flow. Jean went to answer it and returned with a card in her hand.
"Madame will receive?"
"Let me see." The dancer stretched out a languid hand, but at the sight of the name on the card, Count Sergius Polovitch, a sudden flicker of interest came into her eyes.
"I will see him. The Maison Peignoir, Jean, and quickly. And when the Count comes, you may go."
"Bien, madame."
Jean brought the peignoir, an exquisite wisp of corn-coloured chiffon and ermine. Nadina slipped into it and sat smiling to herself, whilst one long white hand beat a slow tattoo on the glass of the dressing table. The Count was prompt to avail himself of the privilege accorded to him. A man of medium height, very slim, very elegant, very pale, extraordinarily weary. In feature, little to take hold of, a man difficult to recognise again if one left his mannerisms out of account. He bowed over the dancer's hand with exaggerated courtliness.
"Madame, this is a pleasure indeed."
So much Jean heard before she went out, closing the door behind her. Alone with her visitor, a subtle change came over Nadina's smile.
"Compatriots though we are, we will not speak Russian, I think," she observed.
"Since we neither of us know a word of the language, it might be as well," agreed her guest.
By common consent, they dropped into English, and nobody, now that the Count's mannerisms had dropped from him, could doubt that it was his native language. He had, indeed, started life as a quick-change music hall artiste in London.
"You had great success tonight," he remarked. "I congratulate you."
"All the same," said the woman, "I am disturbed. My position is not what it was. The suspicions aroused during the war have never died down. I'm continually watched and spied upon."
"But no charge of espionage has ever brought against you."
"Our chief lays his plans too carefully for that."
"Long life to the colonel," said the Count, smiling.
"Amazing news, is it not, that he means to retire?"
"To retire? Just like a doctor or a butcher or a plumber."
"Or any other businessman," finished Nadina. "It should not surprise us. That is what the colonel has always been, an excellent man of business. He's organised crime as another man might organise a boot factory, without committing himself. He has planned and directed a series of stupendous coups embracing every branch of what we might call his profession. Jewel robberies, forgery, espionage, the latter very profitable in wartime, sabotage, discreet assassination, there's hardly anything he has not touched. Wisest of all, he knows when to stop. The game begins to be dangerous. He retires gracefully with an enormous fortune."
Said the Count doubtfully. "It is rather upsetting for all of us. We are at a loose end, as it were.
but we are being paid off on a generous scale. Something, some undercurrent of mockery in her tone, made the man look at her sharply. She was smiling to herself, and the quality of her smile aroused his curiosity. But he proceeded diplomatically.
Yes, the Colonel has always been a great paymaster. I attribute much of his success to that, and to his invariable plan of providing a suitable scapegoat. A great brain, undoubtedly. A great brain. And an apostle of the maxim, if you want a thing done safely, do not do it yourself. Here are we, every one of us, incriminated up to the hilt, and absolutely in his power, and not one of us has anything on him.
He paused, almost as though he were expecting her to disagree with him, but she remained silent, smiling to herself as before.
Not one of us, he mused.
Still?
You know, he is superstitious, the old man. Years ago, I believe, he went to one of these fortune-telling people. She prophesied a lifetime of success, but declared that his downfall would be brought about through a woman.
He had interested her now. She looked up eagerly. That is strange, very strange. Through a woman, you say? He smiled and shrugged his shoulders.
Doubtless now that he has retired, he will marry some young society beauty who will disperse his millions faster than he acquired them.
Nadina shook her head. No, no, that is not the way of it. Listen, my friend, tomorrow I go to London.
But your contract here?
I shall be away only one night, and I go incognito, like royalty. No one will ever know that I have left France. And why do you think that I go?
Hardly for pleasure at this time of the year. January, a detestable foggy month. It must be for profit, eh?
Exactly. She rose and stood in front of him, every graceful line of her arrogant with pride. You said just now that none of us had anything on the chief. You were wrong. I have. I, a woman, have had the wit and, yes, the courage, for it needs courage, to double-cross him. You remember the De Beer diamonds?
Yes, I remember. At Kimberley, just before the war broke out. I had nothing to do with it, and I never heard the details. The case was hushed up for some reason, was it not? A fine haul, too.
£100,000 worth of stones. Two of us worked it, under the Colonel's orders, of course, and it was then that I saw my chance. You see, the plan was to substitute some of the De Beer diamonds for some sample diamonds brought from South America by two young prospectors who happened to be in Kimberley at the time. Suspicion was then bound to fall on them.
Very clever, interpolated the Count approvingly.
The Colonel is always clever. Well, I did my part, but I also did one thing which the Colonel had not foreseen. I kept back some of the South American stones. One or two are unique and could easily be proved never to have passed through De Beer's hands. With these diamonds in my possession, I have the whip hand of my esteemed chief. Once the two young men are cleared, his part in the matter is bound to be suspected. I have said nothing all these years. I have been content to know that I had this weapon in reserve. But now matters are different. I want my price, and it will be big. I might almost say a staggering price.
Extraordinary, said the Count. And doubtless you carry these diamonds about with you everywhere.
His eyes roamed gently around the disordered room. Nadina laughed softly. You need suppose nothing of the sort. I'm not a fool. The diamonds are in a safe place where no one will dream of looking for them.
I never thought you a fool, my dear lady, but may I venture to suggest that you are somewhat foolhardy. The Colonel is not the type of man to take kindly to being blackmailed, you know.
I'm not afraid of him, she laughed. There is only one man I have ever feared, and he is dead. The man looked at her curiously.
Let us hope that he'll not come to life again, then, he remarked lightly.
What do you mean? Cried the dancer sharply. The Count looked slightly surprised.
I only meant that resurrection would be awkward for you, he explained. A foolish joke.
She gave a sigh of relief. Oh, no. He is dead, all right. Killed in the war. He was a man who once loved me.
In South Africa? Asked the Count negligently.
Yes, since you ask it, in South Africa.
That is your native country, is it not?
She nodded. Her visitor rose and reached for his hat.
Well, he remarked, you know your own business best. But if I were you, I should fear the Colonel far more than any disillusioned lover. He is a man whom is particularly easy to underestimate.
She laughed scornfully. As if I did not know him after all these years.
I wonder if you do, he said softly. I very much wonder if you do.
Oh, I am not a fool, and I am not alone in this. The South African mail boat docks at Southampton tomorrow, and on board her is a man who has come especially from Africa at my request, and who has carried out certain orders of mine. The Colonel will have not one of us to deal with, but two.
Is that wise?
It is necessary.
You are sure of this man?
A rather peculiar smile played over the dancer's face. I am quite sure of him. He is inefficient, but perfectly trustworthy. She paused, and then added in an indifferent tone of voice, as a matter of fact, he happens to be my husband. Chapter 1 Everybody has been at me, right and left, to write this story, from the great, represented by Lord Naseby, to the small, represented by our late maid-of-all-work, Emily, whom I saw when I was last in England. Law, miss, what a beautiful book you might make out of it all, just like the pictures. I'll admit that I have certain qualifications for the task. I was mixed up in the affair from the very beginning. I was in the thick of it all through, and I was triumphantly in at the death. Very fortunately, too, the gaps that I cannot supply from my own knowledge are amply covered by Sir Eustace Pedler's diary, of which he has kindly begged me to make use. So, here goes. Anne Bedingfeld starts to narrate her adventures. I had always longed for adventures. You see, my life had such a dreadful sameness. My father, Professor Bedingfeld, was one of England's greatest living authorities on primitive man. He really was a genius. Everyone admits that. His mind dwelt in Paleolithic times, and the inconvenience of life for him was that his body inhabited the modern world. Papa did not care for modern man. Even Neolithic man he despised as a mere herder of cattle, and he did not rise to enthusiasm until he reached the Mousterian period. Unfortunately, one cannot entirely dispense with modern man. One is forced to have some kind of truck with butchers and bakers and milkmen and greengrocers. Therefore, Papa being immersed in the past, Mama having died when I was a baby, it fell to me to undertake the practical side of living. Frankly, I hate Paleolithic man, be he Augignatian, Mousterian, Chellian, or anything else. And though I typed and revised most of Papa's Neanderthal man and his ancestors, Neanderthal men themselves fill me with loathing, and I always reflect what a fortunate circumstance it was that they became extinct in remote ages. I do not know whether Papa guessed my feelings on the subject. Probably not. And in any case, he would not have been interested. The opinion of other people never interested him in the slightest degree. I think it was really a sign of his greatness. In the same way he lived quite detached from the necessities of daily life, he ate what was put before him in an exemplary fashion, but seemed mildly pained when the question of paying for it arose. He never seemed to have any money. His celebrity was not the kind that brought in a cash return, although he was a fellow of almost every important society and had rows of letters after his name. The general public scarcely knew of his existence and his long learned books, though adding signally to the sum total of human knowledge, had no attraction for the masses. Only on one occasion did he leap into the public gaze. He had read a paper before some society on the subject of the young of the chimpanzee. The young of the human race, show some anthropoid features, whereas the young of the chimpanzee approach more nearly to the human than the adult chimpanzee does. That seems to show that whereas our ancestors were more simian than we are, the chimpanzees were of a higher type than the present species. In other words, the chimpanzee is a degenerate. That enterprising newspaper, the Daily Budget, being hard up for something spicy, immediately brought itself out with large headlines. We are not descended from monkeys, but are monkeys descended from us? Eminent professor says chimpanzees are decadent humans. Shortly afterwards, a reporter called to see Papa and endeavoured to induce him to write a series of popular articles on the theory. I have seldom seen Papa so angry. He turned the reporter out of the house with scant ceremony, much to my secret sorrow, as we were particularly short of money at the moment. In fact, for a moment, I meditated running after the young man and informing him that my father had changed his mind and would send the articles in question. I could easily have written them myself, and the probabilities were that Papa would never have learnt of the transaction, not being a reader of the Daily Budget. However, I rejected this course as being too risky, so I merely put on my best hat and went sadly down the village to interview our justly irate grocer. The reporter from the Daily Budget was the only young man who ever came to our house. There were times when I envied Emily, our little servant, who walked out whenever occasion offered with a large sailor to whom she was affianced. In between times, to keep her hand in, as she expressed it, she walked out with the greengrocer's young man and the chemist's assistant. I reflected sadly that I had no one to keep my hand in with. All Papa's friends were aged professors, usually with long beards. It is true that Professor Peterson once clasped me affectionately and said I had a neat little waist, and then tried to kiss me. The phrase alone dated him hopelessly. No self-respecting female has had a neat little waist since I was in my cradle. I yearned for adventure, for love, for romance, and I seemed condemned to an existence of drab utility. The village possessed a lending library full of tattered works of fiction, and I enjoyed perils and lovemaking at second hand, and went to sleep dreaming of stern, silent Rhodesians, and of strong men who always felled their opponent with a single blow. There was no one in the village who even looked as though they could fell an opponent with a single blow or several. There was the cinema, too, with a weekly episode of The Perils of Pamela. Pamela was a magnificent young woman. Nothing daunted her. She fell out of aeroplanes, adventured in submarines, climbed skyscrapers, and crept about in the underworld without turning a hair. She was not really clever. The master criminal of the underworld caught her each time. But, as he seemed loath to knock her on the head in a simple way, and always doomed her to death in a sewer gas chamber or by some new and marvellous means, the hero was always able to rescue her at the beginning of the following week's episode. I used to come out with my head in a delirious whirl, and then I would get home and find a notice from the gas company threatening to cut us off if the outstanding account was not paid. And yet, though I did not suspect it, every moment was bringing adventure nearer to me. It is possible that there are many people in the world who have never heard of the finding of an antique skull at the Broken Hill mine in northern Rhodesia. I came down one morning to find Papa, excited to the point of apoplexy. He poured out the whole story to me.
You understand, Anne? There are undoubtedly certain resemblances to the Java skull, but superficial, superficial only. No, here we have what I have always maintained. The ancestral form of the Neanderthal race. You grant that the Gibraltar skull is the most primitive the Neanderthal found. Why? The cradle of the race was in Africa. They passed to Europe.
Not marmalade on kippers, Papa, I said hastily, arresting my parents' absent-minded hand. Yes, you were saying.
They passed to Europe on...
Here he broke down with a bad fit of choking, the result of an immoderate mouthful of kipper bones.
But we must start at once, he declared, as he rose to his feet at the conclusion of the meal. There is no time to be lost. We must be on the spot. There are doubtless incalculable finds to be found in the neighbourhood. I shall be interested to note whether the implements are typical of the Mousterian period. There will be the remains of the primitive ox, I should say, but not those of the woolly rhinoceros. Yes, a little army will be starting soon. We must get ahead of them. You will write to Cook's today, Anne.
What about money, Papa? I hinted delicately. He turned a reproachful eye upon me.
Your point of view always depresses me, my child. We must not be sordid. No, no, in the cause of science one must not be sordid.
I feel Cook's might be sordid, Papa. Papa looked pained.
My dear Anne, you will pay them in ready money.
I haven't got any ready money. Papa looked thoroughly exasperated.
My child, I really cannot be bothered with these vulgar money details. The bank. I heard something from the manager yesterday, saying I had £27.
That's your overdraft, I fancy.
Ah, I have it. Write to my publishers.
I acquiesced doubtfully. Papa's book's bringing in more glory than money. I like the idea of going to Rhodesia immensely. Stern, silent men, I murmured to myself in an ecstasy. Then something in my parents' appearance struck me as unusual. You have odd boots on, Papa, I said. Take off the brown one and put on the other black one, and don't forget your muffler. It's a very cold day. In a few minutes, Papa stalked off, correctly booted and well mufflered. He returned late that evening, and to my dismay, I saw his muffler and overcoat were missing.
Dear me, Anne, you are quite right. I took them off to go into the cavern. One gets so dirty there.
I nodded feelingly, remembering an occasion when Papa had returned literally plastered from head to foot with rich Pleistocene clay. Our principal reason for settling in Little Hamsley had been the neighbourhood of Hamsley Cavern, a buried cave rich in deposits of the Aurignacian culture. We had a tiny museum in the village, and the curator and Papa spent most of their days messing about underground and bringing to light portions of woolly rhinoceros and cave bear. Papa coughed badly all the evening, and the following morning I saw he had a temperature and sent for the doctor. Poor Papa, he never had a chance. It was double pneumonia. He died 4 days later.
Chapter 2.
Everyone was very kind to me. Dazed as I was, I appreciated that. I felt no overwhelming grief. Papa had never loved me. I knew that well enough. If he had, I might have loved him in return. No, there had not been love between us, but we had belonged together, and I had looked after him and had secretly admired his learning and his uncompromising devotion to science. And it hurt me that Papa should have died just when the interest of life was at its height for him. I should have felt happier if I could have buried him in a cave with paintings of reindeer and flint implements, but the force of public opinion constrained a neat tomb with marble slab in our hideous local churchyard. The vicar's consolations, though well meant, did not console me in the least. It took some time to dawn upon me that the thing I had always longed for, freedom, was at last mine. I was an orphan and practically penniless, but free. At the same time, I realized the extraordinary kindness of all these good people. The vicar did his best to persuade me that his wife was in urgent need of a companion help. Our tiny local library suddenly made up its mind to have an assistant librarian. Finally, the doctor called upon me, and after making various ridiculous excuses for failing to send a proper bill, he hummed and hawed a good deal and suddenly suggested I should marry him. I was very astonished. The doctor was nearer 40 than 30, and a round, tubby little man. He was not at all like the hero of The Perils of Pamela, and even less like the stern and silent Rhodesian. I reflected a minute and then asked why he wanted to marry me. That seemed to fluster him a good deal, and he murmured that a wife was a great help to a general practitioner. The position seemed even more unromantic than before, and yet something in me urged towards its acceptance. Safety. That was what I was being offered. Safety. And a comfortable home. Thinking it over now, I believe I did the little man an injustice. He was honestly in love with me. But a mistaken delicacy prevented him from pressing his suit on those lines. Anyway, my love of romance rebelled. "It's extremely kind of you," I said, "but it's impossible. I could never marry a man unless I loved him madly."
"You don't think..."
"No, I don't," I said firmly. He sighed.
"But my dear child, what do you propose to do?"
"Have adventures and see the world," I replied, without the least hesitation.
"Miss Anne, you are very much a child still. You don't understand."
"The practical difficulties? Yes, I do, Doctor. I'm not a sentimental schoolgirl. I'm a hard-headed mercenary shrew. You'd know it if you married me."
"I wish you would reconsider."
"I can't," he sighed again. "I have another proposal to make. An aunt of mine who lives in Wales is in want of a young lady to help her. How would that suit you?" "No, Doctor, I'm going to London. If things happen anywhere, they happen in London. I shall keep my eyes open, and you'll see, something will turn up. You'll hear of me next in China or Timbuktu." My next visitor was Mr. Fleming, Papa's London solicitor. He came down specially from town to see me. An ardent anthropologist himself, he was a great admirer of Papa's work. He was a tall, spare man with thin face and grey hair. He rose to meet me as I entered the room and, taking both hands in his, patted them affectionately.
"My poor child," he said. "My poor, poor child."
Without conscious hypocrisy, I found myself assuming the demeanour of a bereaved orphan. He hypnotised me into it. He was benignant, kind, and fatherly, and without the least doubt he regarded me as a perfect fool of a girl left adrift to face an unkind world. From the first I felt that it was quite useless to try to convince him of the contrary. As things turned out, perhaps it was just as well I didn't.
"My dear child, do you think you can listen to me whilst I try to make a few things clear to you?"
"Oh, yes."
"Your father, as you know, was a very great man. Posterity will appreciate him, but he was not a good man of business."
I knew that quite as well, if not better, than Mr. Fleming, but I restrained myself from saying so. He continued.
"I do not suppose you understand much of these matters. I will try to explain as clearly as I can."
He explained at unnecessary length. The upshot seemed to be that I was left to face life with a sum of £87.17.4. It seemed a strangely unsatisfying amount. I waited in some trepidation for what was coming next. I feared that Mr. Fleming would be sure to have an aunt in Scotland who was in want of a bright young companion. Apparently, however, he hadn't.
"The question is," he went on, "the future. I understand you have no living relatives."
"I'm alone in the world," I said, and was struck anew by my likeness to a film heroine.
"You have friends?"
"Everyone has been very kind to me," I said gratefully.
"Who would not be kind to one so young and charming?" said Mr. Fleming gallantly. "Well, well, my dear, we must see what can be done." He hesitated a minute and then said, "Supposing, how would it be if you came to us for a time?"
I jumped at the chance. London, the place for things to happen. "It's awfully kind of you," I said. "Might I really? Just while I'm looking around. I must start out to earn my living, you know."
"Yes, yes, my dear child. I quite understand. We will look round for something suitable."
I felt instinctively that Mr. Fleming's ideas of something suitable and mine were likely to be widely divergent, but it was certainly not the moment to air my views.
"That is settled, then. Why not return with me today?"
"Oh, thank you. But will Mrs. Fleming..."
"My wife will be delighted to welcome you."
I wonder if husbands know as much about their wives as they think they do. If I had a husband, I should hate him to bring home orphans without consulting me first.
We will send her a wire from the station, continued the lawyer.
My few personal belongings were soon packed. I contemplated my hat sadly before putting it on. It had originally been what I call a Mary hat, meaning by that the kind of hat a housemaid ought to wear on her day out, but doesn't. A limp thing of black straw with a suitably depressed brim. With the inspiration of genius, I had kicked it once, punched it twice, dented in the crown and affixed to it a thing like a cubist dream of a jazz carrot. The result had been distinctly chic. The carrot I had already removed, of course, and now I proceeded to undo the rest of my handiwork. The Mary hat had resumed its former status, with an additional battered appearance which made it even more depressing than formerly. I might as well look as much like the popular conception of an orphan as possible. I was just a shade nervous of Mrs. Fleming's reception, but hoped my appearance might have a sufficiently disarming effect. Mr. Fleming was nervous too. I realised that as we went up the stairs of the tall house in a quiet Kensington Square. Mrs. Fleming greeted me pleasantly enough. She was a stout, placid woman of the good wife and mother type. She took me up to a spotless chintz-hung bedroom, hoped I had everything I wanted, informed me that tea would be ready in about 1/4 hour, and left me to my own devices. I heard her voice slightly raised as she entered the drawing-room below, on the first floor.
"Well, Henry, why on earth?"
I lost the rest, but the acerbity of the tone was evident, and a few minutes later another phrase floated up to me, in an even more acid voice.
"I agree with you. She is certainly very good-looking."
"It is really a very hard life. Men will not be nice to you if you are not good-looking, and women will not be nice to you if you are." With a deep sigh, I proceeded to do things with my hair. I have nice hair. It's black, a real black, not dark brown, and it grows well back from my forehead and down over the ears. With a ruthless hand, I dragged it upwards. As ears, my ears are quite all right, but there is no doubt about it, ears are de mode nowadays. They are quite like the Queen of Spain's legs in Professor Peterson's young day. When I had finished, I looked almost unbelievably like the kind of orphan that walks out in a queue with a little bonnet and red cloak. I noticed when I went down that Mrs. Fleming's eyes rested on my exposed ears with quite a kindly glance. Mr. Fleming seemed puzzled. I had no doubt that he was saying to himself, "What has the child done to herself?" On the whole, the rest of the day passed off well. It was settled that I was to start at once to look for something to do. When I went to bed, I stared earnestly at my face in the glass. Was I really good-looking? Honestly, I couldn't say I thought so. I hadn't got a straight Grecian nose or a rosebud mouth or any of the things you ought to have. It is true that a curate once told me that my eyes were like imprisoned sunshine in a dark, dark wood. But curates always know so many quotations and fire them off at random. I'd much prefer to have Irish blue eyes than dark green ones with yellow flecks. Still, green is a good colour for adventurers. I wound a black garment tightly round me, leaving my arms and shoulders bare. Then I brushed back my hair and pulled it well down over my ears again. I put a lot of powder on my face so that the skin seemed even whiter than usual. I fished about until I found some lip salve, and I put oceans of it on my lips. Then I did under my eyes with burnt cork. Finally, I draped a red ribbon over my bare shoulder, stuck a scarlet feather in my hair, and placed a cigarette in one corner of my mouth. The whole effect pleased me very much. "Anna the Adventuress," I said aloud, nodding at my reflection. "Anna the Adventuress, Episode 1, The House in Kensington." Girls are foolish things. Chapter 3. In the succeeding weeks, I was a good deal bored. Mrs. Fleming and her friends seemed to me to be supremely uninteresting. They talked for hours of themselves and their children, and of the difficulties of getting good milk for the children, and of what they say to the dairy when the milk wasn't good. Then they would go on to the servants,
and the difficulties of getting good servants, and of what they had said to the woman at the registry office, and of what the woman at the registry office had said to them. They never seemed to read the papers, or care about what went on in the world. They disliked travelling. Everything was so different to England. The Riviera was all right, of course, because one met all one's friends there. I listened and contained myself with difficulty. Most of these women were rich. The whole wide, beautiful world was theirs to wander in, and they deliberately stayed in dirty, dull London and talked about milkmen and servants. I think now, looking back, that I was perhaps a shade intolerant. But they were stupid, stupid even at their chosen job. Most of them kept the most extraordinarily inadequate and muddled housekeeping accounts. My affairs did not progress very fast. The house and furniture had been sold, and the amount realized had just covered our debts. As yet, I had not been successful in finding a post. Not that I really wanted one. I had the firm conviction that if I went about looking for adventure, adventure would meet me halfway. It is a theory of mine that one always gets what one wants. My theory was about to be proved in practice. It was early in January, the 8th to be exact. I was returning from an unsuccessful interview with a lady who said she wanted a secretary companion, but really seemed to require a strong charwoman who would work 12 hours a day for £25 a year. Having parted with mutual veiled impoliteness, I walked down Edgware Road. The interview had taken place in a house in St. John's Wood, and across Hyde Park to St. George's Hospital. There I entered Hyde Park Corner Tube Station and took a ticket to Gloucester Road. Once on the platform, I walked to the extreme end of it. My inquiring mind wished to satisfy itself as to whether there really were points and an opening between the two tunnels just beyond the station in the direction of Down Street. I was foolishly pleased to find I was right. There were not many people on the platform, and at the extreme end there was only myself and one man. As I passed him, I sniffed dubiously. If there was one smell I cannot bear, it's that of mothballs. This man's heavy overcoat simply reeked of them, and yet most men begin to wear their winter overcoats before January, and consequently by this time the smell ought to have worn off. The man was beyond me, standing close to the edge of the tunnel. He seemed lost in thought, and I was able to stare at him without rudeness. He was a small, thin man, very brown of face, with blue light eyes and a small dark beard. "Just come from abroad," I deduced. "That's why his overcoat smells so. He's come from India. Not an officer, or he wouldn't have a beard. Perhaps a tea planter." At this moment, the man turned as though to retrace his steps along the platform. He glanced at me, and then his eyes went on to something behind me, and his face changed. It was distorted by fear, almost panic. He took a step backwards as though involuntarily recoiling from some danger, forgetting that he was standing on the extreme edge of the platform, and went down and over. There was a vivid flash from the rails and a crackling sound. I shrieked. People came running up. Two station officials seemed to materialise from nowhere and took command. I remained where I was, rooted to the spot by a sort of horrible fascination. Part of me was appalled at the sudden disaster, and another part of me was coolly and dispassionately interested in the methods employed for lifting the man off the live rail and back onto the platform.
"Let me pass, please. I am a medical man."
A tall man with a brown beard pressed past me and bent over the motionless body. As he examined it, a curious sense of unreality seemed to possess me. The thing wasn't real. Couldn't be. Finally, the doctor stood upright and shook his head.
"Dead as a doornail. Nothing to be done."
We had all crowded nearer, and an aggrieved porter raised his voice.
"Now then, stand back there, will you? What's the sense in crowding round?"
A sudden nausea seized me, and I turned blindly and ran up the stairs again towards the lift. I felt that it was too horrible. I must get out into the open air. The doctor who had examined the body was just ahead of me. The lift was just about to go up, another having descended, and he broke into a run. As he did so,
He dropped a piece of paper. I stopped, picked it up and ran after him, but the lift gates clanged in my face and I was left holding the paper in my hand. By the time the second lift reached the street level, there was no sign of my quarry. I hoped it was nothing important that he'd lost, and for the first time I examined it. It was a plain half-sheet of notepaper with some figures and words scrawled upon it in pencil. This is a facsimile of it. 17.122 Kilmorden Castle. On the face of it, it certainly did not appear to be of any importance. Still, I hesitated to throw it away. As I stood there holding it, I involuntarily wrinkled my nose in displeasure. Mothballs again. I held the paper gingerly to my nose. Yes, it smelt strongly of them. But then... I folded up the paper carefully and put it in my bag. I walked home slowly and did a good deal of thinking. I explained to Mrs. Fleming that I had witnessed a nasty accident in the tube and that I was rather upset and would go to my room and lie down. The kind woman insisted on my having a cup of tea. After that, I was left to my own devices and I proceeded to carry out a plan I had formed coming home. I wanted to know what it was that had produced that curious feeling of unreality whilst I was watching the doctor examine the body. First, I lay down on the floor in the attitude of the corpse. Then I laid a bolster down in my stead and proceeded to duplicate, so far as I could remember, every motion and gesture of the doctor. When I'd finished, I'd got what I wanted. I sat back on my heels and frowned at the opposite walls. There was a brief notice in the evening newspaper that a man had been killed in the tube, and a doubt was expressed whether it was suicide or accident. That seemed to me to make my duty clear, and when Mr. Fleming heard my story, he quite agreed with me.
"Undoubtedly you will be wanted at the inquest. You say no one else was near enough to see what happened?"
I had the feeling someone was coming up behind me, but I can't be sure. And anyway, they wouldn't be as near as I was. The inquest was held. Mr. Fleming made all the arrangements and took me there with him. He seemed to fear that it would be a great ordeal for me, and I had to conceal from him my complete composure. The deceased had been identified as L.B. Carton. Nothing had been found in his pockets except a house agent's order to view a house on the river near Marlow. It was in the name of L.B. Carton, Russell Hotel. The bureau clerk from the hotel identified the man as having arrived the day before and booked a room under that name. He had registered as L.B. Carton, Kimberley, South Africa. He had evidently come straight off the steamer. I was the only person who'd seen anything of the affair.
"You think it was an accident?"
the coroner asked me. "I am positive of it. Something alarmed him, and he stepped backwards blindly without thinking what he was doing."
"But what could have alarmed him?"
"That I don't know. But there was something. He looked panic-stricken." A stolid juryman suggested that some men were terrified of cats. The man might have seen a cat. I didn't think his suggestion was a very brilliant one, but it seemed to pass muster with the jury, who were obviously impatient to get home and only too pleased at being able to give a verdict of accident as opposed to suicide.
"It is extraordinary to me," said the coroner, "that the doctor who first examined the body has not come forward. His name and address should have been taken at the time. It was most irregular not to do so."
I smiled to myself. I had my own theory in regard to the doctor. In pursuance of it, I determined to make a call upon Scotland Yard at an early date. But the next morning brought a surprise. The Flemings took in the Daily Budget, and the Daily Budget was having a day after its own heart.
"Extraordinary sequel to tube accident. Woman found strangled in lonely house."
I read eagerly. A sensational discovery was made yesterday at the Mill House, Marlow. The Mill House, which is the property of Sir Eustace Pedler, MP, is to be let unfurnished, and an order to view this property was found in the pocket of the man who was at first thought to have committed suicide by throwing himself on the live rail at Hyde Park Corner Tube Station. In an upper room of the mill house, the body of a beautiful young woman was discovered yesterday, strangled. She is thought to be a foreigner, but so far has not been identified. The police are reported to have a clue. Sir Eustace Pedler, the owner of the mill house, is wintering on the Riviera.
Chapter 4.
Nobody came forward to identify the dead woman. The inquest elicited the following facts. Shortly after 1 o'clock on January the 8th, a well-dressed woman with a slight foreign accent had entered the offices of Messrs. Butler and Park, house agents in Knightsbridge. She explained that she wanted to rent or purchase a house on the Thames within easy reach of London. The particulars of several were given to her, including those of the mill house. She gave the name of Mrs. de Castina and her address at the Ritz, but there proved to be no one of that name staying there, and the hotel people failed to identify the body. Mrs. James, the wife of Sir Eustace Pedler's gardener, who acted as caretaker to the mill house and inhabited the small lodge opening on the main road, gave evidence. About 3 o'clock that afternoon, a lady came to see over the house. She produced an order from the house agents, and as was the usual custom, Mrs. James gave her the keys to the house. It was situated at some distance from the lodge, and she was not in the habit of accompanying prospective tenants. A few minutes later, a young man arrived. Mrs. James described him as tall and broad-shouldered, with a bronzed face and light grey eyes. He was clean-shaven and was wearing a brown suit. He explained to Mrs. James that he was a friend of the lady who had come to look over the house, but had stopped at the post office to send a telegram. She directed him to the house and thought no more about the matter. 5 minutes later, he reappeared, handed back the keys, and explained that he feared the house would not suit them. Mrs. James did not see the lady, but thought she had gone on ahead. What she did notice was that the young man seemed very much upset about something. He looked like a man who'd seen a ghost. I thought he was taken ill. On the following day, another lady and gentleman came to see the property and discovered the body lying on the floor in one of the upstairs rooms. Mrs. James identified it as that of the lady who had come the day before. The house agents also recognized it as that of Mrs. D. Castina. The police surgeon gave it as his opinion that the woman had been dead about 24 hours. The Daily Budget had jumped to the conclusion that the man in the tube had murdered the woman and afterwards committed suicide. However, as the tube victim was dead at 2 o'clock and the woman was alive and well at 3 o'clock, the only logical conclusion to come to was that the two occurrences had nothing to do with each other, and that the order to view the house at Marlow, found in the dead man's pocket, was merely one of those coincidences which so often occur in this life. A verdict of willful murder against some person or persons unknown was returned, and the police and the Daily Budget were left to look for the man in the brown suit. Since Mrs. James was positive that there was no one in the house when the lady entered it, and that nobody except the young man in question entered it until the following afternoon, it seemed only logical to conclude that he was the murderer of the unfortunate Mrs. de Castina. She had been strangled with a piece of stout black cord and had evidently been caught unawares with no time to cry out. The black silk handbag which she carried contained a well-filled note-case and some loose change, a fine lace handkerchief unmarked, and the return half of a first-class ticket to London. Nothing much there to go upon. Such were the details published broadcast by the Daily Budget, and "Find the man in the brown suit" was their daily war cry. On an average, about 500 people wrote daily to announce their success in the quest, and tall young men with well-tanned faces cursed the day when their tailors had persuaded them to a brown suit. The accident in the tube, dismissed as a coincidence, faded out of the public mind. Was it a coincidence? I was not so sure. No doubt I was prejudiced. The tube incident was my own pet mystery. but there certainly seemed to me to be a connection of some kind between the two fatalities. In each, there was a man with a tanned face, evidently an Englishman living abroad, and there were other things. It was the consideration of these other things that finally impelled me to what I considered a dashing step. I presented myself at Scotland Yard and demanded to see whoever was in charge of the Mill House case. My request took some time to understand, as I had inadvertently selected the department for lost umbrellas, but eventually I was ushered into a small room and presented to Detective Inspector Meadows. Inspector Meadows was a small man with a ginger head and what I considered a peculiarly irritating manner. A satellite, also in plain clothes, sat unobtrusively in a corner. "Good morning," I said nervously.
"Good morning. Will you take a seat? I understand you've something to tell me that you think may be of use to us."
His tone seemed to indicate that such a thing was unlikely in the extreme. I felt my temper stirred. "Of course you know about the man who was killed in the tube. The man who had an order to view this same house at Marlow in his pocket."
"Ah," said the inspector, "you are the Miss Bedingfeld who gave evidence at the inquest. Certainly the man had an order in his pocket. A lot of other people may have had too, only they didn't happen to be killed."
I rallied my forces. "You didn't think it odd that this man had no ticket in his pocket?"
"Easiest thing in the world to drop your ticket. Done it myself."
"And no money?"
"He had some loose change in his trousers pocket."
"But no note case?"
"Some men don't carry a pocketbook or note case of any kind."
I tried another tack. "You don't think it's odd that the doctor never came forward afterwards?"
"A busy medical man very often doesn't read the papers. He probably forgot all about the accident."
"In fact, Inspector, you are determined to find nothing odd," I said sweetly.
"Well, I'm inclined to think you're a little too fond of the word, Miss Bedingfeld. Young ladies are romantic. I know, fond of mysteries and such like. But as I'm a busy man..."
I took the hint and rose. The man in the corner raised a meek voice.
"Perhaps if the young lady would tell us briefly what her ideas really are on the subject, Inspector?"
The inspector fell in with the suggestion readily enough.
"Yes, come now, Miss Bedingfeld, don't be offended. You've asked questions and hinted things. Just straight out, what is it you've got in your head?"
I wavered between injured dignity and the overwhelming desire to express my theories. Injured dignity went to the wall.
"You said at the inquest you were positive it wasn't suicide."
"Yes, I'm quite certain of that. The man was frightened. What frightened him? It wasn't me, but someone might have been walking up the platform towards us. Someone he recognised."
"You didn't see anyone?"
"No," I admitted. "I didn't turn my head. Then, as soon as the body was recovered from the line, a man pushed forward to examine it, saying he was a doctor."
"Nothing unusual in that," said the inspector dryly.
"But he wasn't a doctor."
"What?"
"He wasn't a doctor," I repeated.
"How do you know that, Miss Bedingfeld?"
"It's difficult to say exactly. I've worked in hospitals during the war, and I've seen doctors handle bodies. There's a sort of deft professional callousness that this man hadn't got. Besides, a doctor doesn't usually feel for the heart on the right side of the body."
"He did that?"
"Yes. I didn't notice it specially at the time, except that I felt there was something wrong. But I worked it out when I got home, and then I saw why the whole thing had looked so unhandy to me at the time."
"Hmm,"
said the inspector. He was reaching slowly for pen and paper. In running his hands over the upper part of the man's body, he would have ample opportunity to take anything he wanted from the pockets.
"Doesn't sound likely to me," said the inspector. "But, well, can you describe him at all?"
"He was tall and broad-shouldered, wore a dark overcoat with black boots, a bowler hat. He had a dark pointed beard and gold-rimmed eyeglasses."
"Take away the overcoat, the beard and the eyeglasses, and there wouldn't be much to know him by," grumbled the inspector. "He could alter his appearance easily enough in 5 minutes if he wanted to.
which he would do if he's the swell pickpocket you suggest. I had not intended to suggest anything of the kind, but from this moment I gave the inspector up as hopeless.
"Nothing more you can tell us about him?"
he demanded, as I rose to depart. "Yes," I said. I seized my opportunity to fire a parting shot. "His head was markedly brachiocephalic. He will not find it so easy to alter that." I observed with pleasure that Inspector Meadows' pen wavered. It was clear that he did not know how to spell brachiocephalic. Chapter 5. In the first heat of indignation, I found my next step unexpectedly easy to tackle. I had had a half-formed plan in my head when I went to Scotland Yard, one to be carried out if my interview there was unsatisfactory. It had been profoundly unsatisfactory. That is, if I had the nerve to go through with it. Things that one would shrink from attempting normally are easily tackled in a flush of anger. Without giving myself time to reflect, I walked straight to the house of Lord Naseby. Lord Naseby was the millionaire owner of the Daily Budget. He owned other papers, several of them, but the Daily Budget was his special child. It was as the owner of the Daily Budget that he was known to every householder in the United Kingdom. Owing to the fact that an itinerary of the great man's daily proceedings had just been published, I knew exactly where to find him at this moment. It was his hour for dictating to his secretary in his own house. I did not, of course, suppose that any young woman who chose to come and ask for him would be at once admitted to the august presence. But I had attended to that side of the matter. In the card tray in the hall of the Fleming's house, I had observed the card of the Marquis of Lomsley, England's most famous sporting peer. I had removed the card, cleaned it carefully with bread crumbs, and penciled upon it the words, "Please give Miss Bedingfeld a few moments of your time. Adventuresses must not be too scrupulous in their methods." The thing worked. A powdered footman received the card and bore it away. Presently a pale secretary appeared. I fenced with him successfully. He retired in defeat. He again reappeared and begged me to follow him. I did so. I entered a large room. A frightened-looking shorthand typist fled past me like a visitant from the spirit world. Then the door shut, and I was face to face with Lord Naseby. A big man, big head, big face, big moustache, big stomach. I pulled myself together. I had not come here to comment on Lord Naseby's stomach. He was already roaring at me.
"Well, what is it? What does Lomsley want? You are his secretary? What's it all about?"
"To begin with," I said with as great an appearance of coolness as I could manage, "I don't know Lord Lomsley, and he certainly knows nothing about me. I took his card from the tray in the house of the people I'm staying with, and I wrote those words on it myself. It was important that I should see you." For a moment it appeared to be a toss-up as to whether Lord Naseby had apoplexy or not. In the end, he swallowed twice and got over it.
"I admire your coolness, young woman. Well, you see me. If you interest me, you will continue to see me for exactly 2 minutes longer."
"That will be ample," I replied, "and I shall interest you. It's the Mill House mystery."
"If you found the man in the brown suit, write to the editor," he interrupted hastily.
"If you will interrupt, I will be more than 2 minutes," I said sternly. "I haven't found the man in the brown suit, but I'm quite likely to do so." In as few words as possible, I put the facts of the tube accident and the conclusions I had drawn from them before him. When I had finished, he said unexpectedly,
"What do you know of brachiocephalic heads?"
I mentioned Papa.
"The monkey man, eh? Well, you seem to have a head of some kind upon your shoulders, young woman. But it's all pretty thin, you know. Not much to go upon, and no use to us, as it stands."
"I'm perfectly aware of that."
"What do you want, then?"
"I want a job on your paper to investigate this matter."
"Can't do that. We've got our own special man on it."
"And I've got my own special knowledge."
"What you've just told me, eh?"
"Oh, no, Lord Naseby. I've still got something up my sleeve."
"Oh, you have you? You seem a bright sort of girl. Well, what is it?"
When this so-called doctor got into the lift, he dropped a piece of paper. I picked it up. It smelt of mothballs. So did the dead man. The doctor didn't, so I saw at once that the doctor must have taken it off the body. It had two words written on it and some figures.
Let's see it.
Lord Naseby stretched out a careless hand. I think not, I said, smiling. It's my find, you see.
I'm right. You are a bright girl. Quite right to hang on to it. No scruples about handing it over to the police.
I went there to do so this morning. They persisted in regarding the whole thing as having nothing to do with the Marlowe affair. So I thought that in the circumstances I was justified in retaining the paper. Besides, the inspector put my back up.
Short-sighted man. Well, my dear girl, here's all I can do for you. Go on working on this line of yours. If you get anything that's publishable, send it along and you shall have your chance. There's always room for real talent on the Daily Budget, but you've got to make good first, see?
I thanked him and apologised for my methods.
Don't mention it. I rather like cheek from a pretty girl. By the way, you said 2 minutes and you've been three, allowing for interruptions. For a woman, that's quite remarkable. Must be your scientific training.
I was in the street again, breathing hard, as though I had been running. I found Lord Naseby rather wearing as a new acquaintance. Chapter 6. I went home with a feeling of exultation. My scheme had succeeded far better than I could possibly have hoped. Lord Naseby had been positively genial. It only now remained for me to make good, as he expressed it. Once locked in my own room, I took out my precious piece of paper and studied it attentively. Here was the clue to the mystery. To begin with, what did the figures represent? There were five of them, and a dot after the first two. 17, 122, I murmured. That did not seem to lead to anything. Next, I added them up. That is often done in works of fiction and leads to surprising deductions. 1 and 7 make 8, and 1 is 9, and 2 are 11, and 2 are 13. 13. Fateful number. Was this a warning to me to leave the whole thing alone? Very possibly. Anyway, except as a warning, it seemed to be singularly useless. I declined to believe that any conspirator would take that way of writing 13 in real life. If he meant 13, he would write 13. 13. 1, 3. Like that. There was a space between the 1 and the 2. I accordingly subtracted 22 from 171. The result was 159. I did it again and made it 149. These arithmetical exercises were doubtless excellent practice, but as regards the solution of the mystery, they seemed totally ineffectual. I left arithmetic alone, not attempting fancy division or multiplication, and went on to the words. Kilmorden Castle. That was something definite. A place. Probably the cradle of an aristocratic family. Missing heir? Claimant to title? Or possibly a picturesque ruin? Buried treasure? Yes. On the whole, I incline to the theory of buried treasure. Figures always go with buried treasure. 1 pace to the right, 7 paces to the left, dig 1 foot, descend 22 steps. That sort of idea. I could work out that later. The thing was to get to Kilmorden Castle as quickly as possible. I made a strategic sally from my room and returned laden with books of reference. Who's Who, Whittaker, a Gazetteer, a History of Scotch Ancestral Homes, and Somebody or Other's British Isles. Time passed. I searched diligently, but with growing annoyance. Finally, I shut the last book with a bang. There appeared to be no such place as Kilmorden Castle. Here was an unexpected check. There must be such a place. Why should anyone invent a name like that and write it down on a piece of paper? Absurd. Another idea occurred to me. Possibly it was a castellated abomination in the suburbs with a high-sounding name invented by its owner. But if so, it was going to be extraordinarily hard to find. I sat back gloomily on my heels. I always sit on the floor to do anything really important, and wondered how on earth I was to set about it.
Was there any other line I could follow? I reflected earnestly and then sprang to my feet delightedly. Of course, I must visit the scene of the crime, always done by the best sleuths, and no matter how long afterwards it may be, they always find something that the police have overlooked. My course was clear. I must go to Marlowe. But how was I to get into the house? I discarded several adventurous methods and plumped for stern simplicity. The house had been to let, presumably was still to let. I would be a prospective tenant. I also decided on attacking the local house agents as having fewer houses on their books. Here, however, I reckoned without my host. A pleasant clerk produced particulars of about half a dozen desirable properties. It took me all my ingenuity to find objections to them. In the end, I feared I had drawn a blank. "And you've really nothing else?" I asked, gazing pathetically into the clerk's eyes. "Something right on the river, and with a fair amount of garden and a small lodge?" I added, summing up the main points of the mill house, as I had gathered them from the papers.
"Well, of course, there's Sir Eustace Pedler's place," said the man doubtfully.
"The mill house, you know." Not where," I faltered. Really, faltering is getting to be my strong point.
"That's it. Where the murder took place. But perhaps you wouldn't like..."
"Oh, I don't think I should mind," I said with an appearance of rallying. I felt my bona fides was now quite established, and perhaps I might get it cheap in the circumstances. A master